Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm excited to be reunited with you, Rebecca, because you were gone on a special trip.
And when I leave, the wheels fall off the cart.
It's true. Now, tell us where you were, because there's a bulk of this episode is devoted to where you were this weekend.
It's a good point. So I was at Netroots Nation with our fabulous executive producer, Alyssa Peterson. We had a tremendous amount of fun. We can't talk about most of it on the air because it was highly debaucherous. But we will talk about the parts that are safe for family radio listening.
I'll talk to you about the other parts off the air.
But also to help us open this fabulous episode, and for a change, we have Alan Pike from Think Progress here for the Weekly Worst as part of our special Weekly Worst opening.
Yay! I was waiting for you to make
a noise.
Back. But
good to be back.
Alan, we've missed you terribly.
It's mutual.
So for those of you who don't know what the Weekly Worst is, and for those who are used to it coming later in the show, what we're going to do is talk about some of the worst news related to poverty that's happened in the past week, and then vote on which we think is the worst.
And most of the time, Tracy wins, but I'm stepping up my game, newly refreshed from Netroots, and maybe that might change this time.
Oh, wow. Throwing down. Okay, what do you have for us, Alan?
All right. First up, first nominee is Rebecca and Alyssa for not bringing me anything from Phoenix.
Which I agree with that.
I think it's just rude.
We did. The things we brought you are actually going to be in this episode, and it's tape from some pretty epic things.
Right. Oh, that was a cute plug. I like that.
Well done. Good judo.
It was a good setup. Good setup,
right.
Alan.
First story is the Michigan Department of Corrections is breaking ties with a for-profit food service vendor called Aramark. The state isn't abandoning its privatization of prison food service, though. It's just changing to a new company. Aramark's tenure in Michigan's prisons was marked by humanitarian violations, including multiple episodes of company staff deciding to feed inmates food that had been in the trash. At one point, there were meatballs in a freezer, and the freezer broke, and they were unrefrigerated for 3 days, and the Aramark person in charge of that kitchen said, screw it, feed them to them anyway.
Ugh. Oh my God.
But again, that kind of stuff is not why the state is breaking ties with this company. It's changed to a new vendor. It says, Governor Rick Snyder's office says that the decision is because they had hit an impasse in negotiations to revise their contract with Aramark. So they're switching vendors. They're not returning to having public workers staff their kitchens. It will continue to be a service that is performed for profit by an out-of-state company.
So it wasn't the maggots. It wasn't the unrefrigerated meatballs. It was something else.
It's a purely business decision, Rebecca.
So oh my God.
Is this new contractor at least a little more humane in how they serve food?
Unclear. Part of the situation here is that Aramark has the bulk of this business around the country. They're one of the biggest companies to do it. They're also, if the name sounds familiar, it might be because they staffed your college cafeteria or the mall food court that you go to. They're a full
so
service food
right
vendor.
Now.
But one of their lines of business is corrections, and it's one of the things that they tout to their shareholders as a growth area within their overall business activity.
So it's the school-to-prison pipeline brought to you by Aramark.
Quite literally. Whoa, that was kind of mind-blowing. Tracy, well done. What's the next one?
Am I going to get in trouble for a fake sponsor like commercial? Anyway, go to the next one.
Well, you guys should charge for this, probably.
This show is not brought to you by Aramark, just to be clear. Alan, what's your next
one? No buzz marketing. Police in Houston arrested a mother named Laura Browder after she left her two children sitting 30 feet away from her in a mall food court while she interviewed for a job. Browder left her 6 and 2-year-old kids in plain sight about 10 brisk strides away, but when she returned to them after her interview, the police were waiting, because another mall patron had apparently reported the kids as abandoned to police.
Are we sure it wasn't an Aramark employee?
I have a lot of theories about the type of person who would make such a call to the police.
So I'm gonna guess that the woman who made this 911 call, she didn't ask the kids like, "Where's your mommy?" or anything like that. Or...
One imagines that she did not. No. One doesn't know, but this kind of thing has happened multiple times in the last couple of years, and you can sort of count on the fact that the times we've heard about this happening probably underrepresent how frequently this happens. But there was a woman named Shanisha Taylor in Phoenix who left her kids in the car while she went to interview for a job at a McDonald's. and got arrested and lost the job that she had just gotten in that job interview. There have been a lot of stories about neighbors calling the cops because somebody's kids are, you know, out on the lawn or letting themselves in with their own house key or whatever.
Or walking home from school. There was one in Maryland. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of these stories feature some sort of a racial component. Often it's women of color and children of color being essentially harassed and having their parenting styles audited by third parties in ways that, as we were saying before we started recording here, sort of baffling to folks our age. I can't imagine how often my folks would have gotten arrested
when
I was a kid if this was the vibe in the culture.
Well, also, I mean, it might not be ideal, right, to leave your kids, you know, 10 feet away in the food court and even have them at your job interview, but really reflective of how expensive childcare is in the United States, right?
Exactly.
It's out of reach for most people. It costs more to have your kid in childcare for a year than it does to go to most public colleges in the United States, right? So obviously not what you would do if you had any alternative.
Right. And here you have a woman who's probably thinking, they're in sight, they're near me, I'm not leaving them at home or in the car. She probably thought she was doing something that was reasonable so that she could actually get a job and take care of her kids. Mm-hmm. But
obviously. Yeah, it's somebody trying to do everything right, you know, trying to do the stuff that we're all told we're supposed to do. Be a productive member of society. Don't, you know, be reliant solely on public assistance to support your family. And in trying to do so, she gets caught up with the law.
Okay.
And now we'll have a criminal record.
We've got one more story, though, before we get to vote. What's the last one?
Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, signed a 20-week abortion ban on Monday. The law makes no exception for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest, nor does it make an exception for mothers who have discovered that their fetus has a high likelihood of some serious developmental disorder. The procedure that the law targets is vanishingly rare. Less than, I think, 1% of all abortions in the United States are conducted after the 20-week mark into a pregnancy. And those that are usually triggered by a woman's discovery that her child would face some sort of brutal limitation in their life due to one or another fetal anomaly. But give Walker points for being consistent, at least, I guess, because when he was in the legislature in 1997, he proposed a bill that would have removed a doctor's legal responsibility to inform an expecting mother of such a fetal anomaly.
Wow.
So as our brilliant executive producer, Alyssa, pointed out before we got on air, I think something that probably should be said is that this is blatantly unconstitutional. Anyone else?
Yeah,
say
I was
it with
say,
me.
Have there been any immediate court challenges to this?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure they'll come if they haven't already.
I feel like we're stunned.
We're stunned into silence.
We just can't do this.
This is something that I didn't know much about. I was a very stereotypical dude who didn't pay much attention to this stuff as of like 2-3 years ago. But I think it was like 3 years ago that this movie came out. There's a documentary that everybody should see that pertains very directly to this particular notion about abortion and about women's rights to make decisions about their own bodies after this arbitrary 20-week mark. It's a documentary called After Tiller, and it's about the last few doctors in the country who do. It's actually later than 20 weeks. I think it's 24 weeks. It's late. It's very late term abortions. There are only like 3 or 4 doctors left in the country who will perform these procedures because one of them was shot and killed in his church by a vigilante, Dr. George Tiller. This was some years back, but it's a really phenomenal piece of filmmaking and journalism about the threats to the lives and livelihoods of these medical professionals who try to perform services for a very, very, very small subset of the population that, for almost never for elective reasons, usually for, again, something to do with the health of them, either their own health or the odds that their kid is gonna be born into a really awful life, make a really heartbreaking decision. And you watch some couples and mothers go through that process and go back and forth about it. It was a really eye-opening experience, even for me as somebody who's thought of myself as pro-choice for a long time.
I think I'll preface this with saying that we here at Talk Power Radio support a woman's right to choose, but I think even with this particular instance, like you were just saying, this is something that people need for pure medical life-saving reasons many times. And I had a friend of mine who was looking forward to giving birth to her daughter, but because of complications and that her daughter was essentially going to have to be living on machines and have multiple surgeries, and essentially the doctors were saying, your daughter is not going to have any kind of quality of life, and right. this pregnancy will be hard on you. They had to leave their state and find a doctor who could perform this procedure. And it was, I think, just then having to like go on the road and not even be in your community and where you live was, you know, added to the stress of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, is there a term for the opposite of mansplaining? Because I feel like Alan, you admitting that you didn't know anything about this and have learned about it, I feel like maybe does that get him credit for like the opposite of mansplaining?
Why else did I say it?
It's called
I'm only here for the ally
woke.
Points.
No.
Okay, I think we have to vote.
All right.
Tracy, you go first.
All right. So for the reasons I kind of just outlined, I got to vote for the Scott Walker one, even though, like Alan, I think my parents would have been arrested multiple times growing up had I not lived in a relatively diverse area where my neighbors actually, you know, knew my parents too. But anyway, I think that the fact that this story, it's unconstitutional, it's constantly playing politics with women's bodies, got to vote for it.
Okay, so Scott Walker, always tempting to vote for. I am not going to vote for him this time because I have to vote for the Aramark one. To me, the fact of finding a new contractor for your private prison work, not because people were being fed maggots, not because they were being fed spoiled unrefrigerated meat, but because of, I don't know, other business decisions, as Alan has outlined for us. There's a total lack of regard for the humanity of people who are behind bars. Got to vote for that one.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole hour on the ways in which our approach as a country to corrections and criminal justice is almost hilariously broken and misguided, and seems to assume that once you've committed a crime, you'll never, ever be better, and you must always be punished and mistrusted by society.
And you're not
ideally,
human anymore,
ideally
right?
physically, right?
Not,
right.
Not
you
human.
Lose your. We deprive people of their humanity.
Yeah.
That being said, I got to vote for. We're gonna have a split, even because I got to vote for this woman in Houston, Laura Browder, getting arrested for leaving her kids 30 feet away while she interviewed for a job. This is somebody, again, doing everything we always tell folks they're supposed to do in this country. We're a country that prides itself on self-reliance and individuality. And if going to the mall to interview for a job and realizing that you can't pay for a sitter and bringing your kids and sitting them down with some French fries 30 feet away where you could get to them in, you know, a cocaine heartbeat if you needed to, is getting arrested for that, and therefore probably losing the job that you might have just gotten, mm-hmm. and then having to check that box on job applications for the rest of your life saying that you've got a criminal record if she gets charged and convicted behind this.
Until we get rid of the box, Alan. Gotta
right,
get rid of
well,
the box.
Yeah. it's absurd. It's representative of this sort of other darker side of the coin of American individualism, yeah. which is that any one jackass with a cell phone mm-hmm. can now ruin your life by deciding, I don't like the way that lady's raising her kids, and I'm going to do something about it.
I think this means we have to bring in Alyssa as a tiebreaker. Alyssa!
And I feel like this is going to bode well for me, knowing Alyssa. Which do you vote for?
And yes, you are correct, Tracy. I will be voting for Scott Walker,
woo!
If only because it contrasts so severely with the bill that was introduced by Representative Barbara Lee, your girl, Tracy,
yeah!
who gave women an affirmative right to abortion, which is unheard of in modern political dialogue around the abortion issue, and that was predominantly supported by women of color, low-income women. And when you look at what Scott Walker is doing, it's part of a broader strategy to undermine women's bodily health and integrity, and so I'm voting for Scott Walker.
Bam.
Very well said.
Well, I might have to... I'm not changing my vote. It's okay.
You already won.
I already lost. We're going to leave
Righteousness
it there.
Righteousness won today. We can all feel good about this.
Righteousness won. And with that...
We've got a great episode.
That's right. Let's let the rest of the episode commence.
Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
As always, it's a pleasure.
See you soon. As you just heard, Alyssa Peterson, our fabulous executive producer, and I went to Netroots Nation this year in Phoenix, Arizona. The agenda was jam-packed with everything from Senator Elizabeth Warren to sessions about immigration and worker organizing and labor unions and reproductive justice, lots and lots of things that we often talk about here on Talk Poverty Radio. Notably absent, however, was any real explicit discussion of poverty. To talk about why that was, and also why and whether it matters, we spoke with Katie Klobusik, a friend of Talk Poverty Radio and a reproductive justice activist.
And Katie, you and I were actually just having a conversation about something that we don't really see here on the agenda at Netroots Nation, which is poverty. Tell us a little bit about what you're thinking.
Hi, thank you for having me on again. It's good to be back on your show. It's not... Right, it's not something we're surprised about. Anybody who does work with poverty and economic justice knows that it's a hard conversation to have, and it's a hard conversation to introduce into spaces. And because even organizing and campaigning has become a very privileged space, you know, to be able to have the time to do that work, to be able to get the funding to do that work, is really a challenge. Poor people do not have a lot of time to do things like sign up for panels and go on it. They just don't have a platform or time. And so it's sort of on those of us who have happened upon a media platform who also have poverty experience to introduce it into these spaces, and also to do a lot of movement teaching, to teach the progressive movements that like this needs to underlie what they do. It's not that they don't care about poverty, it's that they don't have a real experience with it that puts it at the top of the work they do.
So Elizabeth Warren was here earlier today, gave a very well-regarded speech. Everybody got very excited about it. She talked a lot about kind of the economic policy issues that have really fired people up, and which we've been hearing a lot about as the 2016 cycle heats up as well. But why do you think that we're not seeing panels at something progressive like Netroots Nation that actually deal with poverty? Why is that not being talked about here?
I wish I had a really good answer for that. And the best I can do is that it's really a movement-wide problem. What gets talked about at Netroots very often is whatever's on the cutting edge and / newsworthy that's going on with progressive politics and movement. Stuff that's being talked about on air, gets talked about in Radio Row, it gets talked about in speeches. You know, Nina Turner's here, Bernie's people are here, there'll be a town hall with him, right? That's what's going on. Poverty isn't going on. Like, that's not the thing that's happening, even though it's happening all the time.
So what panel would you want to see here that would tackle those issues? What if you could come up with a panel right now, what would it be? Who would be on it?
I want to see every panel talk about it. And that's not me avoiding your question, I promise. I have become all of a sudden in like a militant fashion. If you're not including economic justice as part of your conversation and your movement work, you're doing it wrong. I don't care what your issue is. It needs to be discussed in everything. I heard it talked about in the Beyond Diversity panel that Gloria Adelman led this morning, right? Gloria Malone is on my panel on Saturday. Talks about this a lot. She was one of the co-founders of No Teen Shame, and as a teen parent, like her, she's stigmatized her entire existence all the way down to she's a Black Latina who was young when she got. I mean, everything. She's poor, and she's like, I get shamed for that too. She goes, and I'm not. She said, I'm not poor because I had a kid when I was in high school. I'm poor because no one wants to hire me. She goes, look at me. No one's going to hire me. And those issues, like that needs to be something that's at least addressed in every panel, almost every panel, because it's part of the conversation. We need to make it okay to say the word poverty as we discuss everything.
Another topic that is really notably absent here at Netroots, which you and I were just talking about, is disability. My question is really the same question that I posed about poverty, right? How is that missing, given that 1 in 5 Americans live with some kind of disability? And how are you seeing that impact the experience that people are having here at Netroots?
That is a really challenging topic, too. We have, again, that's another thing that has to be part of every conversation, and we don't talk about it because disability is a stigmatized word to begin with, right? Like technically my extreme ADHD as a disability level, right? I'm very neuroatypical, which makes it hard for me to have a quote-unquote normal job. Those things, people don't like to hear that, right? Like, it's the same thing as if I had a sprained ankle. Like, it's a disability. It's not, it should just be part of my healthcare. It should be part of that. But part of our compartmentalization of healthcare has led to that being a challenge, right? And people, it's a lot the same as people who live in poverty. Their everyday life is a little more challenging. Like, there's just more to do. The checklist is just longer, and not in a way that people with disabilities are less capable. There's just, their day has more logistics. It just does. Their day and their life have more logistics. And because of that, you end up with less time and space to do the organizing work. And very much the way poor people make people uncomfortable, people with disabilities make people uncomfortable, like in an almost visible way. Like, you can watch people squirm if you talk about either issue. And so it's a thing that we don't remember to include in our marginalized community list, and it needs to be on the list, like stat.
Katie Klobusik, always excited to have you on the show. I think basically we have some plotting to do for next year's Netroots to get some stuff talked about that isn't here this year.
I'm in. Let's do it.
While at the conference, we also had lots of conversations with folks who are working in Washington and also working on the ground in states across the country to enact public policies that would cut poverty and expand opportunity in this country. One conversation was with Congressman Mark Takano from California's 41st District.
Congressman, thank you so much for being here for Talk Poverty Radio.
I'm pleased to be here.
So we were really interested in speaking with you about overtime. This is an issue you've really led on, and it's actually something where we've seen some significant movement in the last couple of weeks. Can you tell us a little bit about what we need to do to fix overtime?
Well, thank you for bringing this topic up and discussing it. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Department of Labor sets the threshold under which Americans are entitled to earn overtime. Currently, that threshold is set at $23,000. Only 8% of the salaried workforce qualifies for overtime pay. Compare that to 1975, when 65% of the American workforce, the American salaried workforce, we're not talking about people who earn hourly wages, we're talking about the salaried workforce. 65% of Americans who were on salary earned or could earn overtime. They were entitled to earn overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Obviously, the threshold has not kept pace with inflation, not kept pace with the economy. Now that only 8% are qualified for overtime. So back in January, I wrote to President Obama with a lot of other members of Congress. I led the letter asking him to match the threshold, raise the threshold so that the same percentage of Americans today as in 1975 could earn overtime pay. And do you know what that pay level would be? It would be around $69,000.
That's a big difference from $23,000.
Big difference, right. We urged the president to be bold. We said, be bold, President Obama. Help the middle class. Help working families. We know that the past two decades, we've seen unprecedented levels of productivity. The American worker has never been more productive in history. Corporations have reaped huge gains in profits, but the workers, the American workers, have not shared in that. Their wages have either largely been flat or actually real dollars have declined. So this is one of the tools that we have to raise American workers' wages, and it can be done with the stroke of a pen, with a change of a rule. Through the rulemaking process under the authority of this Labor Standards Act. So the president, just a couple weeks ago, announced his intention to raise threshold from $23,000 to around $50,000. Now, it falls short of what we asked for in the letter, but frankly, we were not expecting him to do that, but we wanted to show him there was support from members of Congress for him to take bold action. And I believe raising it from $23,000 to $50,000 is a bold action. I think many people are saying that this is maybe the second most significant thing he's done for working families beyond the Affordable Care Act. And that's not an exaggeration. This would affect 5 million people.
Now, billionaire entrepreneur Nick Hanauer, who often has spoken out on minimum wage and now overtime reform, he has called this proposal to fix overtime like a minimum wage hike for the middle class. Do you think that's accurate? And tell me a little bit more about who would be helped by this change.
It would help the middle class. It also would help lower income folks because, let's face it, the current $23,000 a year threshold, $24,000, $25,000 a year, that's not a lot of money to raise a family on. So what this would mean for America is economic growth. Republicans like to talk about the growth economy, but real growth is not about trickle down. It's about, a different image. I don't like to call it trickle up, but let's say riding the wave or riding the surf, riding the big wave in that lifts you up. So it's lifting up the middle class by either in one of three ways. So if you're working over 40 hours a week under this new rule and you're earning $40,000 a year, your boss has to pay you time and a half. Overtime, that means extra cash in your pocket. And that's at a salary level where you're going to spend that money more for your family, more in education, but it's going to be more money back into the economy. So that's about growth right there. Your boss could also say, rather than pay you overtime, I'm going to send you home. So instead of having to work those extra hours to keep your job unpaid, you can go home and be with your family. Or guess what? You can get another part-time job and bring in more money for your family that way. The employers, if they still need the work done, they have a choice. They can pay you overtime or they can hire another part-time employee. So, by and large, it means actually, I think, a growth in jobs. It means more leisure time for lots of overworked American families who have been working multiple jobs to make ends meet. And maybe they might just have to work one job with some overtime in order to have a better life for their families. So this is represents a real opportunity to bring about extra added growth into the economy, and it'll help 5 million people. And what I urge all the listeners out there to do, and all the bloggers...
You read my mind, that was my next question.
We've seen the tremendous power of the blogosphere, progressive blogosphere, when it came to net neutrality. They wrote to the FCC when the chairman was wavering on whether he was going to institute real net neutrality. And they changed the game. Millions and millions of emails flooded the FCC, and it changed the game, no doubt about it. It's really important for all of us who believe in a better life for middle-income people, a better life for lower-income people, who all of us who believe in fighting income inequality, it's important for you to write in to the Department of Labor, to Secretary Perez, and let him know you support this rule. The rulemaking process is about listening to the American people. Be sure your voice is heard. So I'm going to give you a website. It's called fixovertime.org. Again, fixovertime.org. You can go there, and there's a link to a page where you can submit your comments and add your voice to the millions of other Americans who believe, as I do, that it's time for Americans to be paid for the work they do. And very often, people have been made into salaried managers, being paid, you know, a fairly low salary. And because they're salaried and called managers with a title, they're actually, in reality, their work duties are that of something very physical, very exerting, work that, duties that most fairly would be classified as deserving of overtime. They're not really managerial.
It's really an abusive overtime policy.
Abuse. They're falsely being labeled managers, and it's a subterfuge to be able to extract more work out of someone, to make them work more than 40 hours. This is about protecting the 40-hour work week. And, you know, I hear a lot of business people often say, why do we need labor unions anymore? You know, we've got all this laws that they were effective at producing. To some degree, it's true that labor unions have been very effective at getting new laws passed, but enforcing them, making them useful, using these laws to actually help the American people, that's a different story. And it's going to take, I applaud the president for moving forward with this, and I hope what we need, though, is the American people to stand with them, and you can do that by going to fixovertime.org and making your voice heard.
And fixovertime.org also has a fun calculator that people can actually use to put in how many hours they're working and some other criteria and see how they would stand to benefit. So a lot that's going on at fixovertime.org, which I should say in full disclosure is a product of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. So I'm really glad that you brought it up.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. And, you know, success breeds success. The more that progressives celebrate these victories and follow through and show working families, actually all Americans, what bold action can lead to, there'll be more of it. People will support more and more of it. This is something that is long overdue for our country.
Well, I share your optimism. And again, Congressman Takano from California's 41st, thank you so much for your leadership in this area. And thank you for taking the time to speak with Talk Poverty Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, broadcasting from Netroots Nation in Phoenix, Arizona. With me to have a little chat about paid sick days and what's going on in New Jersey is Annalilia Mejia, Director of New Jersey Working Families. Annalilia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there's a lot that's going on in New Jersey right now in this area. It's particularly exciting because you guys met with some obstacles in terms of what you could get done at the state level, but that didn't stop you. You found other ways around that roadblock. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on to bring paid sick days to New Jerseyans, despite the fact that there is state opposition.
So very similar to, I think, what advocates have experienced across the country when faced with, for example, congressional gridlock, we've kind of brought all politics back to the localities, or all politics are local. And so in New Jersey, we were faced and we are faced with a governor who refuses to take into consideration the plight of working families and their inability to care for themselves if they get sick and not put themselves at economic risk. So instead of, like I always say, beating our head against this wall of impossibility, of intractability, we opted to move to cover workers at the local level. So we passed 9 municipal ordinances in New Jersey that cover about 150,000 workers, 10% of the workers that we have identified are most vulnerable without this benefit. We've moved it either through collaboration with local government, mayors, councils, etc. We have moved it through local grassroots campaigns to push city councils to adopt, and we've also put it at the local ballot. In 2 municipalities, we called the question in November, last November, and we won by 75% and 86% of the vote.
So we've had conversations on Talk Poverty Radio before about why paid sick days are so important to economic security, but tell us a little bit about why this is really an anti-poverty issue.
When you consider that for a family, a regular, hardworking family, to lose 3 days because a child got a stomach virus or you got caught the flu or you have to go, for example, get medical treatment, 3 days can mean the loss of a month's worth of groceries. And so it's just unfathomable that we put workers in this position where they just go into an economic tailspin for something so simple as like cold, the flu. Everybody gets sick. Everyone gets sick. We all suffer during flu season. And it's not just the workers who are impacted, but it's our community and our economy, because a worker who's economically unstable is not going to the grocery store in the same way, taking their kids to the movies, getting, you know, their car fixed at the same way, if they knew that they could count on that next paycheck.
So, playing devil's advocate, there are a lot of folks in this country who might say that this is just yet another mandate that we're putting on businesses, that it's going to shrink economic growth. What would you say to people who have those kinds of concerns about paid sick days as a policy?
I'll start with the devil has enough advocates. However,
isn't that the truth?
However, I would say, and we've had this conversation with local business owners. Here's the reality. When workers still get sick, and if they do not have a policy that works for them and their families, they're going to show up anyway ill. There's going to be increased presenteeism. There's going to be an impact on the public health. You have to consider that the workforces or the industries that are least likely to have earned sick days are food service, childcare, elder care, retail. These are all people who are the front line with regular customers. Do you really want to have the person caring for grandma or your child or serving food to have to come in sick to work? Consider the public health implications. So I think there is a cost in not acting that we're taking care of here. Presenteeism, the impact on your customer base. And the other piece, again, workers who have economic stability recycle that paycheck right into the local economy. So it actually helps local economies grow.
So my last question for you really, I think, is regarding how we can learn lessons from the successes that you guys have had in New Jersey. There are, I would suspect, a lot of advocates across the country who are pushing for many other policies besides being sick, who are meeting with obstacles in the form of perhaps governors or policymakers who don't see the role of the same way, don't see the value of those policies. Do you think that there's something to be learned from the tactics that you guys have deployed to try to overcome the hurdles in New Jersey at the state level?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, not to sound too scary, but it's almost like guerrilla warfare. And we have to try everything at our disposal. So it's educating workers. It's taking the question to voters or to constituencies, going door to door, having conversations. All politics are local. A councilman, a mayor, an assemblyman, a senator, a governor, they're all very interested in getting reelected. Who stands between them and that reelection? It's all of us. So if we're educated about our power, we're educated about how we can vote our values, I think we could make anyone listen to us. That's power, right? Making someone that doesn't agree with you do what you want them to do anyway. So,
Ana Lilia Mejia, Director of New Jersey Working Families. I'm so glad to have bumped into
you here
at Netroots Nation in Phoenix. Looking forward to having you back on the show sometime soon. And good luck with what's going on in New Jersey.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
One of the most powerful moments that happened during all of Netroots Nation this year happened during the presidential town hall. Moderator Jose Antonio Vargas asked Governor O'Malley a question about his record on mass incarceration, and a protest of Black Lives Matter protesters broke out and changed the entire tenor of the discussion. To round out this episode, we're going to play a clip for you of what that sounded like.
I don't know. You might, you know, this probably...
What's happening?
happening. You want some more water?
No, I'm good.
You're good.
Good morning, Netroots. My name is Tia Oso. Today is my last day as the Arizona organizer for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. I want to welcome you to Arizona. And thank you so much.
Sure.
So Netroots Nation being in Arizona is significant for several reasons, right? Arizona is indigenous land. We're called as Phoenix, Arizona, but really the border was drawn, right, by white supremacist manifest destiny. And without the innovations, right, of the indigenous people, right, building the canals, this would be an uninhabitable desert, correct? On Monday, that was the July 13th, it's the 2-year anniversary of the Black Lives Matter, creation of the Black Lives Matter hashtag, right, political project. That has moved, right, from an online political project to an on-the-ground social justice initiative that has reignited the fight for racial justice across the globe, right, and Black struggles across the globe. There's also the 1-year anniversary marking the death of, Eric Garner. And also, Sandra Bland died in police custody in Texas. So right now, here today, we want to take a moment at Netroots to acknowledge the lives lost every 28 hours, but specifically the Black women's lives that are lost.
How many hours?
Every 28
every
hours.
Every 28 hours.
Okay,
yes.
Black woman, man, or child. Because we think it's important, and we demand, just as I demanded from Netroots several times, and then decided to go ahead and create, right, a local focused, Black focused space to connect local Black community organizers with organizers who are here from around the country for Netroots, right? Because that's something that we had to do, right? That we should not have had to do, right? Black Roots. Hashtag Black Roots. Welcome to Arizona, where Monica Jones, a Black trans woman, cannot walk down the street. Today cannot walk down the street, okay? Welcome to Arizona, where the Martin Luther King holiday was repealed by a Republican governor, and we had to take initiative to put a ballot referendum, right, to entrench that you will honor the legacy of Black people. If we're gonna call this a progressive space, we must always and unapologetically and unequivocally center Black leadership that has made every single gain of progress in this country.
You're right.
So we are going to hold this space. We are going to acknowledge the names of Black women that have died in police custody. And then, Governor O'Malley, we do have questions for you about what is your agenda going to be to make sure that Black lives do matter, and that as the leader of this nation, will you advance a racial justice agenda that will dismantle, not reform, okay? Not make progress, but that will begin to dismantle structural racism in the United States. No, we're going to do the action, reading the names of Black women.
Just starting over there.
Yes. We call the names of Black women
who have done this. So we have questions for him too. Wait, let's figure out a way to do this together. Give yourself a name. I have no idea what's happening. Is that? I can't do that. The moment I take the mic away from her. No. I'm moving.
If I die in police custody.
If I die in police custody.
Call my mom first.
Call my mom first.
Then burn this sh- down.
Then burn this sh-
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And underdogs could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money. money for the food and healthcare, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?